I'm Dr. Jim, renal attending. I'm sure I'll be seeing more and more of you guys throughout the year. So today my topic is urinalysis. How many of you have ordered a urinalysis? Okay, good. So that means you know everything about it, right? And this should be a piece of cake for you. As you see, urinalysis is known as a major non-invasive tool. You know, we've all ordered it. It's very simple to do. And it's relatively simple to interpret. It is known as a poor man's renal biopsy because, you know, it's non-invasive and you could have a glimpse of what's going on inside the kidney. It may provide information about severe disease severity, but it doesn't always correlate. You know, we know many people with chronic kidney disease for many years may have a bland urine. That doesn't mean anything, but if it's active, it tells you something. The specimen should be examined as soon as possible, within 30 to 60 minutes of voiding. That's to prevent bacterial colonization that can complicate matters. And once you look at the specimen, to process the specimen, you want to centrifuge it at about 3,000 RPM for 3 to 5 minutes. And then you analyze the supernatant with the urinary UA dipstick. So, but even before you do that, the first thing you notice as you're collecting the specimen is the color of the specimen. Normal color is some shade of yellow, depending on how concentrated the urine is. If it's white, it indicates that there is presence of white blood cells or phosphate crystal, so that's abnormal. If it's green, it actually happens that sometimes it can be green. It's usually due to food additive, a color dye, such as methylene blue, or medications like amitriptyline, propofol. If it's red or brown, it means that there is some characteristics of blood in there, you know, whether it's whole blood or disintegrated blood. So that's another sort of clue to what's going on. The next characteristic you've noticed is the turbidity of the urine. Normal urine should be clear, which means that you should be able to read words if you hold up a piece of paper in back of the urine. But if it isn't, it means, if it's turbid, it means that one of several things. There are cells in it, white cells, red cells. There may be bacteria or protein. Protein appears as foamy urine. Lipids, crystals, as we mentioned, phosphate crystals, or salt. Some compound of a salt that may precipitate out. And finally, the odor of the urine, which we probably would prefer not to analyze, but sometimes you can't help but notice it. Normal odor is urinoid, and I don't think I need to describe what that is. We know what that smells like. But if it smells like ammonia, it may be represent a presence of a UTI, especially an ammonia-causing organism, or prolonged urinary retention. Diabetics, patients with DKA can exhibit a sweetish smelling urine due to the presence of acetone. Sometimes it may even smell like sulfuric acid, which is like a rotten egg smell, and that's due to cysteine decomposition. Or certain drugs and foods give characteristic smells. Like if you've ever had asparagus, you know what to expect in the urine. And certain antibiotics give a distinct smell. This is a typical UA test strip. As you see, it gives you many characteristics of the urine. We will go through each and every one of those characteristics. So. Protein. Nephrologists are always interested in presence of protein in the urine. Now, the protein that's detected by a dipstick is primarily albumin. When you see positive protein on a urine dipstick, it means that it is there, which means it's specific, but it's not sensitive. And this happens because the UA only picks up protein when you have more than 500, about 300 to 500 milligrams per day that's excreted. And therefore, it cannot detect microalbuminuria, very little amounts of protein, or immunoglobulin light chains, because immunoglobulin light chains are not albumin proteins. So again, it is specific but not sensitive. And if you have somebody who you think should have protein in the urine, but the UA is negative, you really want to quantify the urine protein. In the past, if we have a negative dipstick with somebody we suspect have immunolight chain, such as multiple myeloma patients, we used to apply this reagent called a sulfa salicylic acid test, the SSA test. How many of you have heard of this test? It's probably not very practical and useful anymore because we can just quantify the protein in the lab. We don't even have to do this test. But this is a qualitative test to try to pick out the protein that's been missed by a UA. And basically, it detects all proteins in the urine, albumin and non-albumin proteins. And if you suspect somebody with it, with a negative dipstick, you add a part of this solution. So you mix one part of urine supernatant with three parts of this SSA solution, and you mix it up. And if it precipitates, it turns turbid, that means there's presence of protein. And this will then reveal your myeloma patients that may have a negative dipstick. So a question for you, if a diabetic patient, for example, has a positive urine protein on the UA, do you expect this test to be positive? Yes. Why? Exactly. It's a trick question. It detects all proteins. So you don't do this test if the UA already picks up protein. You only do it if it's a negative dipstick, but you're still suspecting presence of protein. Next, we look at the pH. The pH can be very useful. I know it's oftentimes ignored, but it's useful to reflect the degree of acidification of the urine. Now, the degree of acidification of the urine depends on the person's diet. What is the source of most of the acid in our body? What gives us all the acid in our body that that we need to excrete on a daily basis? Sorry? The intake. It's the protein intake. Certainly there's acid secretion in your stomach, but it's on a daily basis. It's a protein from amino acid decomposition that we need to get rid of. And if we don't get rid of it, we become severely acidotic. And so the urine pH ranges from 4.5 to 8. What's normal serum pH? All right, so somewhere near 7.4, the range being 7.35 to 7.45. Compare that with the range of the urine pH, 4.5 to 8. That's huge, right? And again, the urine needs to be very flexible in dealing with the acid-base composition of the body at any given moment, and so that we can keep our plasma pH within such a narrow limit, compatible with life. Now, we look at the pH mostly to figure out what's going on in a metabolic acidotic patient. So if a patient has metabolic acidosis, what should the urine pH be? Should it be low or high? It should be low. Why? Right, so the kidney's response is to excrete acid, increase acid production, which will then decrease the pH. But if it's high, what does that tell you? Something's wrong with the kidneys. And that's how we may diagnose presence of RTAs, renal tubular acidosis. The kidney's not doing its job. Or it may represent the presence of an infection. Again, ammonia-causing organisms, such as Proteus organisms especially, can give you very high pH. And therefore, in order to evaluate the urine pH, the urine needs to be sterile. It cannot be infected. And then you can figure out and go from there what's going on. Ketones. What does the presence of ketones in the urine tell you? Okay, the person could have starvation or fasting ketosis. Certainly, I think soon enough all of you would have seen a patient with DKA with ketones in the urine. And it can also, those are the two major. And if you're on a low-carb diet, you know, the Atkins diet, which is no longer in favor, you could have ketosis. We used to have medical students and residents with lots of ketones in the urine, which is, you know, wasn't a good time. But bear in mind, the UA only picks up two types of ketones, acetone and acetoacetate. It does not pick up beta-hydroxybutyrate. So sometimes if you're evaluating and following a patient with DKA and you see that the ketones have gone in the urine, that doesn't mean that they no longer have ketones because they may still have the beta-hydroxybutyrate. That's a rough tool that we use. Next, the bilirubin and the urobilinogen. Do we find normal bilirubin in the urine? You really shouldn't. I mean, there is a little bit that gets... remember, bilirubin gets converted into urobilinogen in the intestine. So that little bit gets reabsorbed in the intestine, which then gets excreted in the urine. But not a lot, and it should really be negative on a normal UA. So what conditions is it elevated? Exactly, especially if it's conjugated bilirubin, and what instances cause hyperbilirubinemia? Obstructive jaundice, cirrhosis, hepatorenal disease. We see a lot of this. And in fact, the urine looks orange-tinged, and you could almost tell bilirubin by looking at the urine. Next, the osmolality and the specific gravity. On the urine dipstick, actually, what they tell you is the specific gravity, not the osmolality. Osmolality you need to specifically order on a urine specimen. So osmolality tells you the number of particles per unit volume. It correlates generally with specific gravity. Specific gravity, on the other hand, is a weight of the urine compared to a weight of water. So what is specific gravity of water? Very good, one. And so if you recall on the urine dipsticks, the specific gravity of most urines that you send out is 1.010, 1.020. It's generally a little heavier than urine, than water. So they correlate. So if a person's dehydrated, you'll have a higher specific gravity. There are more solutes per amount of water or urine volume. Similarly, the urine osmolality would increase in that instance as well, because the urine is very concentrated. The two numbers diverge when there is presence of high molecular weight molecules in the urine, such as rate of contrast material, mannitol, glucose, because those substances are very heavy, therefore will raise your specific gravity. If you've ever looked at the specific gravity of a diabetic patient with uncontrolled glucosuria, the specific gravity is generally 1.030, which is very high. Person who just got contrast material, you check their UA, specific gravity would be very high. But the urine osm may not really change because the number of particles is still similar to before. Again, it's the specific gravity that shows on the UA. The urine osm you'll have to order separately. Glucose. If you find glucose in the urine, what does that indicate? Hyperglycemia. And what else? What threshold usually do you spill urine into the glucose into your urine? 180. 180 is the number that we teach you. It varies, you know, depending on the person. It depends on pregnancy, actually. Pregnancy women, they have a lower threshold to spill glucose. But, 160, 180. In poor countries, in third world countries, that's all they have to go by. They don't have glucometers, so they check urine dipsticks for glucosuria. What else does it indicate if you see glucosuria? What is Fanconi syndrome? Good. And why? Why is it that proximal tubular dysfunction gives you glucosuria? Yeah, exactly. That's where we reclaim most of our amino acids, glucose, and other electrolytes is in the proximal tubule. So if there's dysfunction there in Fanconi's, not only do you see glucose in the urine, what else do you see? Anybody else? What else do you see in Fanconi syndrome in the urine? Yes. What else do you reabsorb proximally? sodium you will see, yes. Somebody mentioned bicarb. Yes, you'll see bicarb. Not so much calcium. Calcium isn't reabsorbed so much approximately. Phosphates, uric acid are generally the other two things that we look for to confirm Fanconi syndrome. Okay. And those are pretty much the only instances you should see glucose in the urine. Finally, hematuria and pyuria are probably, you know, the most common things we look for. Dipsticks are very sensitive in detecting RBCs in the urine. 1 to 2 per high power fuel is considered normal. Anything more than that is not. And pyuria, so basically the way the test strip detects pyuria, white blood cells, is to detect presence of leukocyte esterase, which is an enzyme inside the white cell. And to help confirm presence of bacteria, detects presence of nitrites, which is a substance that's made by the bacteria Enterobacteriaceae. However, there are instances where you can have white cells without presence of an infection, right? What are some of those instances? TB, sero-TB, you hear about all the time, and so in the right patient, you want to rule that out. Good. Any inflammatory disorder, any allergies can cause increased white cells. Allergic interstitial nephritis is definitely possible. And in those cases, you don't see any bacteria, just a lot of white cells. And nephrolithiasis, you can see as well. Okay, so those are the major things that you'll see on the urine test strip. Next, as nephrologists, we want to look at the urine sediment, and actually as any doctor, looking at the urine sediment is very helpful. Looking at the urine sediment, you may find crystals, bacteria, white or red blood cells, casts, and artifact. So crystals, you can see the calcium crystals are most common, calcium phosphate, calcium oxalate. You may find uric acid crystals in patients with gout or acute uric acid nephropathy. Magnesium ammonium phosphate crystals or triple phosphate crystals you'll see in presence of producing organism. Or cysteine crystals. When do you see cysteine crystals? I think I hear it. Cystinuria. And when do you see cystinuria? What condition? What condition? See, we don't know it very well because we don't see these patients. It's a pediatric condition. It's a metabolic disorder of congenital cystinosis, where you're unable to basically degrade the cysteine amino acid, which is cysteine is a combination of two amino acids, and you're unable to degrade it appropriately, and it accumulates. And one of the organs it damages is the kidney. You'll find cysteine crystals in the urine. So just to give you some examples, what are these crystals? Very good. Calcium oxalate. This is what's dubbed as the back of the envelope crystal. Very typical square-shaped crystals. This is actually also a calcium crystal. The difference between this and this is the number of OH moieties. This has one OH, is a monohydrate oxalate crystal, and this is a dihydrate oxalate crystal. This, surprisingly, is also a calcium oxalate crystal. It's needle-shaped, and it's another form of monohydrate crystals. Not typically seen this way, but you will see it in a patient who drinks antifreeze, actually, glycoline, ethylene glycol. If you suspect that, you look at the urine, one of the pathognomonic features is calcium oxalate crystals that present as needle-shaped in the urine. So that would be a find if you diagnose that patient. These are uric acid crystals. The typical description is that they are rhomboid shape, four sides, and they show, this is under polarized light, so it has this birefringence. If you recall, if you've ever seen uric acid crystals from a knee or a gout joint, it does not look like this. It's needle-shaped. And the reason is that the pH of the urine is different from the pH of, synovial fluid. And so it appears differently. But this is how it looks like in the urine. These are your triple phosphate crystals, otherwise known as Coffin-Look crystals, again associated with protease-producing organisms. Notice how big they are and what thick borders they have, and that's how you really determine their characteristic. And these are the cysteine crystals, and what's typical about this is that they've got six sides. They're hexagonal. This is the only crystal that have six sides. So if you see a six-sided crystal, you've made the diagnosis of cystinuria, hence cystinosis. No other condition will give you this type of crystal. What are these? Calcium oxalate. These? Triple phosphate. Good. Coffin-Look crystals. These? Yeah, good. When in doubt, count number of sides. You know, you have four. It's not, back of the envelope, and it's, so yeah, uric acid, very good. And this? Cysteine, yeah. Next, on the urine sediment, we look at bacteria. Presence of bacteria really depends on the quality of the collection. Again, if the urine's been sitting around in a Foley catheter in the ICU for 2 hours, 3 hours, probably it's a contaminant. But it's also more significant if you've got presence of other white cells. If you have bacteria without any white cells, it's probably colonization, overgrowth, as opposed to a true infection. The urine and the bladder, of course, should be sterile, but it may be contaminated as it passes through the bladder, so you really want a clean couch when you try to figure out if a person has a UTI or not. What are these little guys? Not the round things, the linear things. Yeah, it's bacteria. In fact, these are rods. Yeah, these are most likely gram-negative rods. And notice it's a lot of them, and they're much smaller, right, than the cells, than the neighboring cells. And that's another clue to tell you that they're bacteria, the size of the organism. They should be able to be small enough to attack the cells, or they're smaller than neighboring cells. And they move. They wiggle. That's another clue. Presence of hematuria. Sometimes you'll have a young person come to your clinic who have hematuria discovered on a dipstick on a routine physical, and they're all worried. You just have to keep on checking it, because transient hematuria, especially in young individuals, is considered normal. You just want to make sure it's not persistent. If it is persistent, then you want to see if it's gross or microscopic. The morphology of the RBCs is very important when you look under the microscope. If it's uniform and monomorphic, every RBC looks like the next one, that means generally it's extrarenal bleeding. It's outside the kidney, it's in the ureters, it's in the bladder. Call urology, But if it's dysmorphic, if it looks like it's got blebs or Mickey Mouse shaped, or it's got a bite taken out of it, then it's glomerular source of bleeding. Interesting pearl to know is that if a person tells you that they're urinating clots, blood clots, chances are the source is also extrarenal. Inside the kidney, there is an anticoagulant, urokinase, that keeps the blood from clotting. But if it does clot, it's outside the kidney, so keep that in mind. So this is a picture of monomorphic RBCs. All the RBCs look similar to another. This is a nearby WBC, which you see is about 1.5 times bigger than the RBCs. It's got should have a nucleus with a granulated cytoplasm. Of course, RBCs don't have nuclei, so that's another way you tell them. Any idea what these cells are? Yeah, why do they look like this? Yeah, exactly. They've been sitting around for a while. And this is sometimes if you have a slide that's been sitting around for a while, it's dried up. That's what it looks like. The RBCs are crenated. What about these guys? What are they? RBCs. How would you describe them? Are they monomorphic? No. So what are they? Dysmorphic, which means it's a glomerular source of bleeding. technically speaking, we can only call RBC dysmorphic if we examine it under a phase contrast microscope, not a regular microscope, but we've sort of gone away with just calling it regularly shaped RBCs, dysmorphic RBCs. But these are highly unusual. You know, this one looks like a moon crescent, which is unusual. This is just a higher power of the same thing. So presence of white cells in the urine, again, they're larger than red cells. They've got a granular cytoplasm, multi-lobed nuclei. Pyuria alone indicates a presence of infection. Of course, you like to see bacteria. But if you see it in presence of other stuff, you know, like CAS, a protein artifact, it may not mean that much because anything can give you a lot of white cells. It's just like an acute inflammatory response. If you see eosinophils, it may indicate allergic interstitial nephritis. However, it's not specific for allergic interstitial nephritis because it can also indicate presence of cholesterol embolic disease. Can you pick out eosinophils when you look at a urine sediment? If you spin the urine yourself and you look under a microscope, can you pick out eosinophils? Why not?
Because they will have granular cytoplasm. Are there granular cytoplasm?
They have special granules. You know, they have red granules, right? They need to have a special stain in order to pick them up. But basophils, eosinophils, it's called a Wright stain or Hansel stain that the lab does. So you have to send it to the lab. You can pick out white cells on the urine sediment by yourself, but not eosinophils per se. Sometimes you can make out lymphocytes. Again, you need special staining for lymphocytes. And presence of lymphocytes in the urine is quite unusual, but it may indicate lymphoma, infiltration of lymphocytes in the kidney. Very unusual. Presence of chronic tubular interstitial disease, also not very common. These are examples of stained white cells. That's why they're a little blue. Again, a granular cytoplasm is probably all you can pick out. Remember, white cells are perfectly circular. So if you see a cell that's not perfectly circular, chances are it's not a white cell. Red cells are circular, but they are also biconcave, and they don't have a granular cytoplasm. Next are epithelial cells. So epithelial cells can be shed anywhere along the GU tract. All we're really concerned about are the renal tubular epithelial cells, not the squamous epithelial cells that you can find, you know, through the urethra or the contaminated from the vagina. So they are big. They are the biggest cells that you're going to see on the urine sediment. They are 1.5 to 3 times bigger than the white cells, and they are round and they have a large nucleus. Maybe normal, but you really don't want to see it. Or indicative of ATN, pyelonephritis, nephrotic syndrome, basically tubular injury. And this is an example of an epithelial cell, tubular epithelial cell specifically. Look how big it is compared to a white cell, a big nucleus, very thick, almost looks like a tire, you know, very thick, very obvious. What kind of cells are these? Yeah, these are squamous epithelial cells that you've learned since, you know, I'm sure maybe even high school. They are different from tubular epithelial cells. They are actually quite large, but they're thin. And sometimes you may even miss them because they're so thin. They've got a small nucleus but a huge cytoplasm. In comparison to an epithelial cell, tubular epithelial cell, which is a little smaller but perfectly round, easy to spot because they've got thick borders, a large nucleus. The only thing that can be confused with a tubular epithelial cell are transitional epithelial cells from the bladder. They actually look quite similar. Next, CAST. We all care about CAST because they hopefully gives us a diagnosis. Why? So CAST are CAST because they conform to the shape of the renal tubule. That's why they you know have those particular shapes. The matrix that forms the CAST is mostly the most abundant protein in the urine, which is TAM horse fowl protein. It forms the scaffolding for all the junk to hold, you know, the CAST together. Different types of CAST. We have hyaline CAST, red cell CAST, white cell CAST, epithelial cell CAST, granular CAST, waxy CAST, and broad CAST. Okay. Now, the theory of castogenesis is that first you begin with cells. In the face of acute kidney injury or acute renal failure, you hardly ever see cast if you don't have acute renal failure. The reason is that you need slowing down the urine output. If you have good urine output, you're not going to have the time and the conditions to form this cast. So this is a very concentrated area with a lot of protein and a lot of junk that forms the cast. So you start with, a bunch of cells, and you form the cast, and over time it may degenerate into a coarse granular cast, and over time into a fine granular cast, and eventually, if the patient's underlying condition doesn't resolve, into a waxy cast. Waxy cast indicates long-standing kidney disease, usually seen in patients with chronic kidney disease. This is just a theory. It doesn't necessarily have to go this order. What's this? Good, yeah, Hyaline cast. So the characteristics, is it? What does that indicate? Is it? Right, it could indicate, it could be present in normal people. It actually doesn't have significant meaning. It could be normal, it could be abnormal. If you want to pin somebody having abnormal, a diagnosis, you have to look for something else. You can't just say Hyaline cast. But what the characteristics of Hyaline cast is that it's very transparent. It's easy to miss. It's acellular. It's got nothing. It's transparent, but it's in the shape of a cast. What are these? What kind of cells? I hear RBCs. Any other takers? Tubular epithelial cells. Okay, we've got one more option, I think. So remember all the cells that you mentioned, what the characteristics of the cells are. So RBCs, do they have a cytoplasm? Like, what do they look like? They should have a clear cytoplasm, right? And here you see stuff in it. So what do you... Yeah, because you see lots of granules. Even tubular epithelial cells, you don't see such a granular cytoplasm. To be fair, to figure out what type of cells, it's really helpful to see what else is around it, to compare the sizes. Here you don't see anything else around, but the fact that it's a conglomerate of pretty much circular cells with a granular cytoplasm should be a WBC cast. What are these? Yeah, these are RBCs. So they're smaller. If they're relatively small if you compare it to nearby cells, and this shows you a biconcave disc. They're perfectly circular. For a tubular epithelial cell, they should be bigger. You may not be able to depict that here, but also you should see a nucleus. And here you're not seeing a nucleus, you're just seeing the biconcavity here. What are these? Yes, finally, right? Tubular epithelial cells. So they're much bigger. Tubular epithelial cells are not perfectly circular. They can look like an oval. They're kind of bouncy. They conform to the shape of pressure. And therefore, when combined, you see they almost look like a polygon here. But they are big. They've got a big nucleus. They've got a cytoplasm. And that's how you know this is tubular epithelial cell cast. What are these? Yeah. So what does that mean, a fatty cast? What's in it? Yeah, cholesterol droplets or lipid droplets, exactly. So look at these are just look like little fat droplets, right? And the characteristic of fat droplets is that they're perfectly circular. They're of all different sizes. What condition do you see this? Good, nephrotic syndrome. It could be minimal change disease. It could be membranous nephropathy. It could even be diabetic nephropathy, nephrotic syndrome. And this is under polarized light. This is a characteristic Maltese cross. tells you it's a fat droplet or a cholesterol ester droplet. What's this? Yeah, I hear it. That's very good. A waxy cast. So the characteristic of a waxy cast is that it's acellular. It's got this homogeneous material. It's very bland looking, and it's quite big. Another name for a waxy cast is a broad cast. A waxy cast could look like this, or it could look like a piece of intestine. They wiggle around. But again, they've got clear defined borders, so you know it's not a Hyaline cast. And they have material. It's not like they're completely transparent, but it's a homogeneous acellular material. And you should see it in the right clinical setting, which is chronic kidney disease. What are these? Yeah, your famous muddy brown casts. What are muddy brown casts exactly? What, if I were to tell you what, you know, specifically what this cast is, what is it?
Tissue debris.
Sorry, tissue debris? There could be tissue debris inside the cast, but more specifically, what kind of cast? Remember, we listed the list of casts. What? It's a granular cast. It could be a coarse granular cast. It could be a fine granular cast, depending on how coarse. They look pretty coarse here. But muddy brown casts are granular casts. It's just that there's so much of it, and they're quite dark looking. Sometimes you can make it out just by spinning the urine and seeing how it's brown on the slide. It indicates decreased urine output and acute kidney injury. And the whole conglomeration of granular casts. Sometimes you can just see one or two granular casts, but you want to see this, you know, large numbers of casts with this brown pigment that diagnoses ATN. What's this? So this is one granular cast. It's hard to call this a muddy brown at this point. A muddy brown, we generally, again, see in a bunch of different casts, and it's quite dark, quite brown. Given one, it could be muddy brown, but we like to see more of this. So just given just one cast, we call this a relatively fine granular cast. What are these? RBCs, good. So look at the size of the granules versus the cells, right? And RBCs are the small cells that you should see on the urine. The granules are much smaller, so that's another hint that these are granules it's not a cellular cast, at least. Okay, sometimes you could find just weird stuff, which, you know, infections like Trichomonas, it's got a little tail, it'll swim across for you. Or sperm, it'll swim as well, you know, characteristic sperm. This is interesting. This is talc powder, and it's got a scallop shape. And this could be, you know, it could fool a lot of us. We may think that this is a cell, like a tubular epithelial cell or something. But you want to see that there's really no cytoplasm, no nucleus here, and just out of the ordinary. So this is just an extraneous finding, a powder that the patient has applied, obviously not a sterile, clean urine. And fiber, you know, clothing fiber is very common. So the way to figure out artifact from real findings is that if the finding is like, the size of it is so out of proportion with anything else that's in the area, cells, bacteria, then chances are it's an artifact. And this piece of fiber is huge compared to, you know, the other stuff. Maybe this is a crystal, and this is just huge. It's not microscopic. Okay, now for the cases. We've got a 46-year-old man who presents with acute flank pain. When he moves around, he is mildly febrile, and his exam is unremarkable, and his UA shows hematuria. What are you thinking of? I hear nephrolithiasis, and I hear pyelonephritis. Good. But it could be either. This is the type of person you'll see in the emergency room, generally. And therefore, the urine might be quite helpful here. And what do you see? What are these? Sorry? Good. Calcium oxide crystals. And calcium-based crystals, especially calcium oxide, are the most common causes of renal stones. And therefore, this happens to be nephrolithiasis in a patient. usually with pilo, you see a higher fever. You know, to have developed pilo with flank pain, it's a higher fever. We have a 22-year-old woman with no past medical history, presents with dysuria, ammonia-smelling urine, increased urinary frequency. What will her UA show? High pH, very good. So the UA will show specifically what white, but what represents white cells on the UA? Leukesterase, good. What else? Nitrites, good. And what do you expect on the urine sediment? Yeah, you should see lots of WBCs in bacteria. And in fact, you do. You've seen the slide already. So basically, we've got red cells that have been sitting around for a while, but lots of bacteria just floating around. And what's this? Surprisingly, you find this. Yeah, triple phosphate crystal, which is consistent with a Proteus organism, which is a gram-negative rod. A 57-year-old woman with poorly controlled hypertension, diabetes, retinopathy, presents with a creatinine 1.8 and lower extremity edema. I'm sure all of you have seen this patient in clinic. What do you expect her UA to show? Okay. A lot of protein, a little bit of protein? Like what range? How do we describe it? Okay, so definitely greater than 300 milligrams for 24 hours because you found it on the urine. You will find it on urine dipstick. But more than that, more specifically, what range? Yeah, nephrotic range. And the clue that points to that she may have nephrotic range is that she has edema. So she should have nephrosis. What do you do with this patient? How do you treat her if that's what you find? ACE inhibitors is the only drug that we have to treat proteinuria at this point in time. ACE has a lot of limitations, but that's all we have. But blood pressure control is paramount. If she happens not to tolerate ACE, if she develops hyperkalemia, then she may not be an ACE candidate, but we still have to control the blood pressure. That's by far the most important thing to worry about. Oh, I guess I don't have a UA on her. 3-year-old boy brought to a pediatrician for increasing facial and peripheral edema for 8 days. Urine shows 4.2 grams of protein, cholesterol is 450, and albumin is 3.0. What does he have? Yeah, minimal change. And the reasons minimal change is basically his age and the fact that he has nephrotic syndrome. And what's this? Fatty cast, good. Because these circles are differently shaped, they're not terribly clear, but what makes it clear is that when you put it under a polarizing lens, it's a little overexposed, but you can make that one Maltese cross here. 45-year-old, hospitalized for peripheral edema, proteinuria, protein, the urine, 6 grams, albumin's low, cholesterol's high, creatinine's 1.6. His records show that he had 1+ proteinuria for 4 years previously. What might he have? Okay, good. You start with nephrotic syndrome. He has nephrotic syndrome. And then you go down the differential for nephrotic syndrome. This is a little bit more difficult given his age. Now he can have anything. You know, he's no longer a 3-year-old boy. So what can he have? Membranous. Membranous is the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome worldwide. Diabetes is getting up there, but so far it's still membranous worldwide, especially middle-aged Caucasian males is the most common. What else could he have? Right, so just think nephrotic syndrome. So SLE can give you nephrotic syndrome, but it can also give you nephritic syndrome. But membranous, what else? FSGS, especially in our population. African Americans, reason for nephrotic syndrome, number one reason is FSGS, secondary, besides diabetes, an HIV or HIV-associated FSGS. Okay, so membranous, FSGS. Diabetes, you can rule that out quickly because you'll know their glucose numbers. And you have to think about things. Cancers, very good. So, you know, then it goes into a realm of membranous, primary, secondary. primary membranous just happens. Secondary membranous usually happens secondary to cancers, carcinomas, epithelial cell cancers. And so you'll have to do a colonoscopy or a prostate exam, chest x-ray to rule out a cancer. So, right, all those are in your differential. And this is what you find on the urine, which tells you what? Which unfortunately doesn't tell you that much. It just confirms that he has nephrotic syndrome. But it opens the door for your differential. And then that's when you start the serologic workup with, you know, infectious etiologies like HIV, like hepatitis, and more clinical history from the patient. I think this should be the last one. 52-year-old woman, sudden onset of edema, dark urine, headaches, malaise, blood pressure 150 over 105, urine 900 cc's over 24 hours. She made 1.7 grams in 24 hours, creatinine 4.5, UN68. She had normal renal function 1 month ago. First of all, how would you describe her case? Like, what does she have now? A nephritic? Good. So a nephritic syndrome, not nephrotic, because your protein-creatinine ratio is not nephrotic range. What else? Sorry? Yeah, you really worry about that. First of all, it looks like she has acute renal failure, right? The newest term for acute renal failure is acute kidney injury. But she had normal renal function a month ago, so this is fairly acute. And glomerulonephritis, you do worry about because she has a significant amount of protein. It's not in the nephrotic range, but it's still enough that it can come from the glomerulus. So you do worry about acute glomerulonephritis. And this is what you see. And this is when looking at the urine really helps. What is this? Very good. RBC count. So what does that tell you? It's what? Glomerulonephritis. Glomerular source of bleeding with acute kidney injury, with decreased urine output, and that's why the cast is able to form. And then you go ahead with the workup. This is an emergency as far as nephrologists are concerned because we see a cellular cast, an RBC cast with acute kidney injury, decreased urine output. We have to emergently biopsy this person, but before we get the biopsy results, which won't come back for up to a week sometimes, we need to pulse this person with IV steroids, with immunosuppression. And we do that. That ties us over until the biopsy results comes back, but we'll give the person at least 3 days of solumedrol because this is acute glomerulonephritis for sure. We just don't know the etiology. It could be lupus. It could be HIV. It could be crescentic glomerulonephritis, ANCA-associated glomerulonephritis. But until we know the etiology, we can't be more targeted in giving her treatment, but we can give general immunosuppression, which is solumedrol. So this is when looking at the urine really makes a difference. Okay, I think that's it. Any questions? All clear, right? I didn't even realize. You mean on the computer, the lab range, they changed it?
There's an automated one, and there's a manual one.
Uh-huh. So what's the new range?
So the range before was, the normal range, I think it was 3. And now the normal range is up to 70.
70?
Yeah.
So,
we never really, I guess, we don't look at UAs that carefully because we always look at our own urines, but I don't know either.
I think they changed from the field to the per microliter.
Yeah,
now we have to convert with 0.1A, something like that.
Oh, I see. Well, that makes sense. So it's a smaller volume, that, or larger volume. Larger volume, that's why. Well, that makes life a little harder, right? So you guys know where